Well, the Buddha
then congratulates Saraswati.
And he praises her for her words concerning
spells and mendicaments,
as the sutra says. The Brahmin Kaundinya then speaks. He's already appeared in chapter 2. He now addresses the great goddess Saraswati. He says that she is worthy of worship. She possesses great asceticism, is famous in all the worlds, is a giver of boons, of great virtues. And he then proceeds to describe what seems to be a very archaic form of the goddess. He says, dwelling on a peak, beautiful, clad in a grass garment, wearing grass clothing, she stands on one foot. So, what does all this mean? Clearly, there's some connection with the sacrificial system, or at least with the culture that grew out of that system. But why is the goddess said to dwell on a peak? What is the meaning of her standing on one foot? No doubt there is a meaning, but I must confess that in this case, I've not been able to find it out. And I suspect it would require a good deal of research into ancient Indian, especially Vedic, symbolism. Meanwhile, your guess is as good as mine. But the wearing of grass clothing is more explicable. Grass played an important part in Brahminical ritual. Again, the associations are quite different, especially Kusha grass and Dabba grass. These were regarded as sacred grasses and are still widely used in India for religious purposes. So that we can see there's a definite connection between this form, this very archaic form of the goddess, and the Brahminical sacrificial system, Brahminical culture, between the goddess on the one hand and all that that culture represents on the other. Indeed, the mere mention of sacred grass, of Kusha, of Dabba, sparks off all sorts of associations in the Indian mind, especially in the Orthodox Hindu mind. It's difficult for us to appreciate this because we're not familiar with that kind of cultural language. So let's take a parallel example from our own culture. This may help us to understand. Let's take the example of mistletoe. Suppose someone mentions to us mistletoe. Well, it'll spark off all sorts of associations. I wonder what you are thinking of. You may think of the ancient druids, of oak trees, golden sickles, human sacrifice, Julius Caesar. You may also think, quite wrongly, of Stonehenge. Stonehenge had nothing to do with the druids. Think of Eisteddfods. I hope I pronounced that correctly. Think of Wales, devolution, Welsh dragons, bards, the poet Gray, Edward III, Christmas. So for us, mistletoe will have all these associations and many more. So it's just the same with sacred grass, with Kusha, with Dabba. For the Indian, these spark off all sorts of associations. Sacred grass, or sacrifices, Brahmins, ancient sages, rishis, with long white beards and sacred threads, asceticism, the hermit life, getting away from it all, Valmiki, the Ramayana, the gods, the Vedas, the Sanskrit language. For the Indian, for the Orthodox Hindu, sacred grass, Kusha, Dabba will spark off all these associations and many more. Now all these associations are bound up with certain emotions, even with very deep emotions. So the fact that Sarasvati is described as wearing grass clothing not only sparks off these associations, it also brings in the emotions, brings them into the sutra, places them at the service of the spiritual development of the individual, places them at the service of the golden light. So from this example, we can see how important it is to find what we may call cultural equivalents. Just as mistletoe is a sort of cultural equivalent for kusha grass or dubba grass, we can see how important it is that Buddhism should speak the cultural language of the people it is trying to reach. But it's time we got on with the chapter. Having described Saraswati as standing on a peak, etc., the Brahmin Kaundinya says that all the gods assembled and they asked Saraswati to speak. And this the goddess does. She recites a long spell, followed by a prayer that one's knowledge may prosper in such things as textbooks, verses, magic books, doctrinal books, and poems. Kaundinya then praises the goddess in a beautiful hymn, after which the chapter comes to an end. Now I'm going to read this hymn because it gives a good description of Saraswati in a fully developed Puranic form. May all the hordes of Bhutas hear me. I will praise the goddess whose face is supremely, extremely beautiful, who among women in the world of gods, Gandharvas and lords of Asuras, is the supreme, chief, excellent goddess. Saraswati by name has members that have piles of adornments of various virtues. Her eyes are broad. She is brilliant in merit. She is full of the virtues of pure knowledge. She is beautiful, like a variety of jewels. I will praise her by reason of her distinguished virtues of excellent speech, because she causes excellent supreme success, because of her famous teaching, because she is a mine of virtues, because she is pure and supreme, because she is brilliant as a lotus, because her eyes are fair and excellent, because her residence is beautiful, because her appearance is beautiful, because she is thoroughly adorned with inconceivable virtues, because she resembles the moon, because her splendor is pure, because she is a mine of knowledge, because of the superiority of her mindfulness, because she is the best of lionesses, because she is a vehicle for men, because she is adorned with 8 arms, because her appearance is like that of the full moon, because of her heartening speech, because of her soft voice, because she is endowed with profound wisdom, because she causes the accomplishment of the best deeds, because she is an excellent being, because she is honored by the Lord of gods and Asuras, because she is praised in all the dwellings of a multitude of gods and Asuras, because she is continually worshipped in the abode of a multitude of Buddhas. So this is the hymn which the Brahmin Kaundinya sings in Sanskrit verses. This is a prose translation, but the original, of course, is in verse, is in meter.